Since I'm the longest-serving member, probably, of Birmingham and the Shakespeare Institute, having met Allardyce Nicol for the first time in 1947. I'd like to take you back to those years at the end of the war, because we've forgotten what it means to live in an age of austerity, even if the politicians keep telling us we're doing so. What it meant then, at the end of the war, was living on heavily rationed diet, one egg a week, 2 ounces of this, 2 ounces of that. Everything was rationed, including clothing at this time. And in the savage winters of 46, 47, there was no fuel, or at least it was very hard to get fuel. So I have an image in my mind of students huddled round an old stove in the University of Birmingham building that used to be in Colmore Row and Edmund Street in the centre of Birmingham, huddled round an old coal-burning stove, trying to keep warm in their rags still derived from years of austerity during the war. It was into this kind of scene, where if you walked along the main roads in Birmingham, you'd be struck by the enormous amount of bomb damage which had upset the mermaid who used to flourish on the top of the Edmund Street building and was rather toppled. It was into this extraordinary scene that Allardyce Nicol arrived in 1946, making what seems an extraordinary move from being head of theatre arts at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. I mean, the most distinguished post in theatre arts in America, to come to Birmingham. And the story, I think, is a fascinating one. I'm not going to bore you with all the details. But Allardyce Nicol arrived to astonish, I would say, the students at Birmingham. He was tall and elegant, always beautifully dressed in handsome suits. When he sat down displaying his ankles, everybody was struck by his socks, which were silk or nylon, nylon being a new fabric at the time. And the cigarette holder he always kept close by him also contributed to this sense of elegance. He had been known as Dandy Jack when he was a student in Glasgow. And something of that remained with him. He was a wonderfully elegant, tall, elegant man. And that went with a lot of charm, but I think it was also, to some extent, a protective coating as well. Anyway, what brought Allardyce Nicol here? I think can be focused, I would say, in the figure of Sir Barry Jackson, who ran the Birmingham Repertory Theatre and was a man of fortune, who spent his fortune on theatre. In 1946, he took over as artistic director at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, having been appointed there in a year or so earlier. And it's no coincidence that Allardyce Nicol arrived at that time. they had a great vision, a vision of a theatre that would work in tandem with, would share its activities with an academy, a sort of University of Shakespeare. A vision that, alas, never materialized because the feuds among the governors of the Royal Shakespeare Theatre led to Barry Jackson's resignation in 1948. But I think from the point of view of the Institute, it was a wonderful transition that Allardyce Nicol made at that time. We owe an enormous debt to him because he, when this other initiative failed, he set up the Institute. He created Shakespeare's Survey, the first major English language Shakespeare periodical, which predated Shakespeare Quarterly and all the others, except the German Shakespeare's Jahrbuch. He invented the Institute. He managed to establish an international conference, biennial conference, Shakespeare conference, which is still running. And he also contrived to get from the Ford Foundation money to purchase the microfilms of the short title catalogue books, which gave the Institute a leg up, a library that was richer even than the British Museum for the early modern period. And I mean, this is really a staggering achievement, I think, which set us all going. As Michael Dobson has already said, he appointed three of us as fellows, Ernst Honigman, myself, and John Russell Brown, who's sitting next to me, and to whom I will now pass the baton.